Most of us don't think much, if at all, about breathing. It's automatic. But if you can't breathe, it rapidly becomes a crisis. This is the People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Whether it's pneumonia, influenza, or respiratory syncytial virus, lung infections can be serious. Few of us have heard of human metapneumovirus, but it sure leads to a horrible cough that's tough to shake.
Wildfires put a lot of smoke in the air, and that makes breathing difficult. How can you keep from inhaling particulate matter?
Asthma and COPD interfere with lung function.
Coming up on the People's Pharmacy, breathing better despite pollution, infections, asthma, or COPD.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, the ultimate measure of public health is death, particularly avoidable mortality. A recent study looked at such preventable deaths of adults under 74 in the United States and in comparable high-income countries between 2009 and 2021. Avoidable mortality included both deaths that could have been prevented with public health measures and those that should have been avoided with timely and appropriate medical care. During this time, mortality rates rose in the U.S., but they dropped in other wealthy countries, such as those in Europe. The authors note that, despite spending more on health care than every other high-income country, the U.S. has comparably higher avoidable mortality, which includes deaths that can be avoided through timely prevention and access to high-quality health care.
ProPublica reports that the FDA has finally visited a drug manufacturing plant run by Glenmark Pharmaceuticals in Madhya Pradesh, India. The company makes generic drugs for the U.S. market. According to ProPublica, extended-release potassium chloride pills have been linked to 8 American deaths. The FDA is supposed to visit foreign manufacturers in a timely manner, but it had apparently been 5 years since the last inspection at this facility. The agency found that the company's equipment was not always cleaned properly between batches and that the company's risk assessment process was inadequate. ProPublica reports that the uneven dissolution of the potassium chloride pills was especially troubling.
Heart disease remains the number one killer in the U.S. after decades of public health initiatives to lower cholesterol. High cholesterol is seen as the most important risk factor for heart disease. But a new study in the journal Nutrients reviews cholesterol levels of Sardinians in their 90s. Sardinia is considered a blue zone for longevity. The volunteers were recruited in 2018 and followed through December of 2024. The median total cholesterol was right around 200. People with LDL cholesterol above 130 survived significantly longer than those with LDL cholesterol below 130. This runs counter to everything that American cardiologists espouse. The authors observe that moderate hypercholesterolemia does not preclude the oldest adults from obtaining advanced ages, contrary to common belief.
Speaking of lipids, a study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition found that consuming pecans as a snack improves lipids and lipoprotein levels. This was a 12-week, single-blinded, randomized controlled trial. Volunteers were randomly assigned to receive 57 grams of pecans a day. That's equal to about 2 ounces. The control group was instructed to follow their usual diet. The participants who received pecans for snacks experienced lower total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, and triglycerides compared to the usual diet group.
When people started experiencing strange allergic reactions after eating meat, many physicians were stumped. Alpha-gal syndrome was discovered in 2009, but it took years for many healthcare providers to realize that their patients were suffering because of a Lone Star tick bite. The syndrome can involve delayed digestive tract symptoms, hives, difficulty breathing, or swelling of the lips, throat, and tongue. It's been far more common in the South and Southeast, where Lone Star ticks are especially widespread. Now, though, scientists have found that the Lone Star tick is not the only culprit. Two separate reports in the journal Emerging Infectious Diseases document alpha-gal syndrome outside the range of the Lone Star tick. Patients in Maine had been bitten by blackleg ticks, also known as deer ticks. A wildlife biologist in Washington State developed anaphylaxis after a bite from a western blackleg tick. With very elevated alpha-gal IgE levels, she needed to avoid mammalian meat, including milk and gelatin. People everywhere now have even more reason to avoid tick bites this spring. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. Did you catch something nasty this past winter? An awful lot of people suffered from colds, flu, COVID, and other respiratory tract infections. Some are still coughing, and I'm one of them.
Today we're talking about how to keep your lungs healthy. How good are antivirals like Tamiflu or Xofluza when it comes to influenza? What about vitamin C or vitamin D?
To learn more about treating infections of the lungs, we're talking with Dr. Roger Schwelt. He's an associate clinical professor at the University of California, Riverside School of Medicine, and an assistant clinical professor at the School of Medicine and Allied Health at Loma Linda University. Dr. Schwelt is quadruple board certified in internal medicine, pulmonary diseases, critical care medicine, and sleep medicine through the American Board of Internal Medicine. His current practice is in Beaumont, California, where he's a critical care physician, pulmonologist, and sleep physician at Optum California.
Welcome back to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Roger Schwelt.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
Dr. Schwelt, you are board certified in internal medicine, critical care medicine, sleep medicine, and for today's conversation, pulmonary diseases. So just wondering, what lung diseases often bring patients into the hospital? What do you see most often?
Well, we see all sorts of things, and it depends on the season. So at this time of the year, we are going to be seeing a lot of flu. We're going to be seeing pneumonia. But generally speaking, throughout the year, we might see obstructive lung disease or COPD exacerbations. We might see pneumonia as well. Things of that nature. Asthma is something that we also tend to see as well, especially in the younger population.
Dr. Schwelt, what I'm wondering is, a patient comes in to see you because they're having trouble breathing or they have a horrible cough. And how do you figure out what the diagnosis is? There probably is a long list of possibilities that it might be.
Yeah, so this is what they teach us in medical school, and it's absolutely true. When you get out into the real world and start to treat patients, history is 80 to 90% of the diagnosis. So we find out, you know, and this is kind of a list of things that we go down. We find out the chronology of that cough or shortness of breath. When did it start? How long has it been going on for? And then we try to figure out what makes it better, what makes it worse. And then when you go through all of those things, it starts to become clear which pathway you're going to go. Here's a visual. If you remember The Price is Right, where they had Plinko and they would pluck this little disc and you put it at the top and it would sort of bounce around and go down into a pocket. That's kind of what happens when we're talking to patients about symptoms, is depending on what the answer to one question will be, that will determine the next question that comes up, that will determine exactly where I could find out where this diagnosis is going.
Well, I want to drill down a little deeper when it comes to an upper respiratory tract infection, because there are so many different pathogens that can be involved. So there's this thing called human metapneumovirus, And Terry and I caught that a couple of years ago. It was apparently very common in the Portland, Oregon area. And Terry's sister came. We were a family gathering. And she was coughing and she was sick. And man, we all got it. So there's that thing, which is nasty.
The cough lasted a really long time, like almost 6 weeks.
But then there's also influenza. And it's not just influenza A, there's influenza B, and there are different variants. And then there's bacterial pneumonia.
And then there are differences in individuals. Joe caught a cold about a month ago.
Actually, now close to 6 weeks.
And he is still coughing. But
and Terry got over it in like 4 days, and she was fine. And I got over it in about 4 or 5 days, but the cough, oh man, it just won't go away.
Yeah.
What do you do when you've got all these different upper respiratory tract infections? How do you know one from another?
That's a good question. So ultimately, how you figure this out is with the help of science and genetic testing and PCR and things of that nature. Because there's, as you mentioned, there's so much overlap in the symptoms, and there's so much overlap in how people present with the symptoms, that's really the only way you can tell. And it's important because we now have medications and things of that nature that are specifically only for particular viral infections. But just to take it back a little bit, if you were to look at the published symptoms, if you will, for the colds versus the flu versus, you know, RSV or human metapneumovirus. So for instance, the flu, you're typically going to have fevers, fatigue, and body aches. That's the hallmark of the flu. Whereas with colds, you know, it might be more of a sore throat and maybe less likely to have a fever. With RSV or human metapneumovirus, you know, wheezing can be an issue because that can get down deep into the lung. But, you know, as you said, it's different in everybody. So what you do is you take a swab, and we actually have this in the emergency room where it can test for like 17 different viruses. There's a bunch of viruses that cause colds. There's obviously influenza A, there's influenza B, RSV, COVID. And depending on the antigen testing in this case, or PCR, depending on how they do it, you're going to get a positive, and then you're going to be able to tell that this is the virus that's actually causing the problem.
So you're testing in the emergency room, and that will tell you if this patient, for example, has influenza A, for which you could prescribe one of two medications that would help the person get better faster.
Well, I'd like to drill down on those meds because we keep being told, you know, Tamiflu, it doesn't really work that well. You might get 1 day less illness. But now there's Xofluza, X-O-F-L-U-Z-A, and that's a one-time dose, and that's maybe a little bit better. And then there are the old ones like amantadine that's been around for decades. And we've actually taken Tamiflu. And for us, it's worked really well and really fast.
Except for that one time it made me sick.
Yeah, there was the nausea thing. So help us understand these antivirals, would you?
Yeah, so they're affecting the different life cycles or the life cycle of the flu virus. As you mentioned, there's oseltamivir, which is known as Tamiflu. There's zanamivir, that's Relenza. There's permavir, that's Rapivab. They're all in common in the sense that they're neuraminidase inhibitors. They're preventing the virus from using that enzyme that allows it to go into the cell and bind and do these sorts of things. And so they all work that way, and it depends on whether or not you're giving it orally or intravenously. The other one that you brought up works a little differently. That one is the Xofluza, as you were mentioning. And that one actually has to do with the replication of the flu. It's what we call a cap-dependent endonuclease inhibitor. That's a funny way. Basically, it's an enzyme that helps with its genetic material and replication and things of that nature. But they all try to do the same thing. They try to break up this life cycle of the virus so it can't replicate, it can't get into other cells, and it can't cause you to be sick.
Well, you know what always drives me a little crazy, Dr. Schwelt, is that you have to take these drugs really fast. In other words, you know, you start to get symptoms of influenza. You can't wait 2 or 3 days.
You mean early? You need to take the drug as soon as you know you're sick.
As soon as you're, you know, like the first symptoms, that then they're the most effective. But at this time of year, it's sometimes hard to get in to see the doctor, and not everybody wants to go to the emergency department to see you. And so the question is, how do you get your doctor to write a prescription fast enough to do any good?
Yeah, it's difficult. it's almost impossible to get in to see them that fast. What is happening now with online medical records is they have a patient portal a number of times where you can actually write in to the nurse or the MA that's there, say what's going on, and hopefully that message gets passed along and a prescription can get written pretty quickly, especially if that patient is well known to the physician. So that's one way of doing it.
And my last question about flu, vitamin C. It has been so controversial for decades. We saw a paper not too long ago that said, you know, Linus Pauling, he may have been onto something. What's your take on vitamin C and the common cold?
Well, you know, it is an essential nutrient. There's no question about it. Whether or not there are studies that show effectively that it can help with the flu is still in question. There are some that seem to indicate that it might. There are other ones when they've reproduced it where there's been negative studies. So it's not definitive and conclusive. But I would say that we do have actually very good evidence that sunlight is very beneficial for the flu. And I would highly recommend that people get out into the sun at least 20 to 30 minutes a day and get that type of nutrient. It's not really vitamin D, although you do get vitamin D from the sun. I think there's actually more going on there.
You're listening to Dr. Roger Schwelt. He's an associate clinical professor at the University of California, Riverside School of Medicine, and an assistant clinical professor at the School of Medicine and Allied Health at Loma Linda University. Dr. Schwelt is quadruple board certified in internal medicine, pulmonary diseases, critical care medicine, and sleep medicine through the American Board of Internal Medicine.
After the break, we'll find out if sun exposure might help you ward off the flu.
Florence Nightingale was very enthusiastic about fresh air as well as sunshine for respiratory infections.
How can we improve air quality indoors? Better ventilation is essential, but it can be expensive.
Wildfires and smoke are contributing a lot to air pollution in certain parts of the country. What does Dr. Schwelt recommend? Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. Modern medicine has seemingly forgotten the role of sunlight and ventilation for staying healthy. But our guest today suggests that we need to pay attention to these critical elements.
To help keep you breathing better, we'll find out about the importance of air quality, both indoors and outside. This can be especially important as we enter another wildfire season.
We're talking today with Dr. Roger Schwelt. He's an associate clinical professor at the University of California, Riverside School of Medicine, and an assistant clinical professor at the School of Medicine and Allied Health at Loma Linda University. He's also the co-founder and chief presenter for MedCram.com. This online medical education company offers instructional videos for healthcare professionals as well as ordinary people.
Dr. Schwelt, you say sunlight can be helpful for the flu, and I'm wondering, Are we talking about preventing the flu, or are we talking about treating the flu?
Well, actually, both. There was an interesting study that was done at the Harvard Kennedy School. What they did was they looked at the flu in its season. And one of the issues with trying to figure out what exactly is causing the flu season to happen every December for us in the Northern Hemisphere is the fact that cold weather, lack of sunlight, and change in humidity always happen at the same time. Well, in 2009, we had the H1N1 flu epidemic, and it hit very early. In fact, it peaked in the summertime. And this allowed them to decouple all of these things and really truly see what it was that caused the flu and what we could be doing to prevent the flu from happening. Well, they showed that when they looked at CDC data in terms of the index of flu, and they looked at solar radiation data, the conclusion that they came to was that sunlight was very strongly protective against getting influenza. And they published that paper just a few years ago at Harvard. The interesting thing about that is that not only did this occur at the national level, but this also occurred within a state level. So the more sun there was in a particular area, the less influenza that they noticed. Now, this was helpful in terms of prevention. But we also have a lot of good historical data, although it's not randomized. Back in the 1918 pandemic, there was a number of camps that actually had outdoor camps. And it was because they knew observationally that patients that were outside in the sun seemed to get better faster from the influenza that they had already gotten.
That is fascinating. And of course, as soon as you talk about outdoor camps, we're also thinking about ventilation. It's going to be much better outdoors, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and it's interesting that you say that, because even if you go another 50 years prior to that, there was a very prominent nurse that we all know, Florence Nightingale. And when she was asked after her stint of taking care of these British veterans in the Crimean War, they asked her, what was it that was the most efficacious in terms of treating the patients? And she said, number one, fresh air, no question. But she said a close second to that was direct sunlight.
Well, Dr. Schwelt, you have just pushed one of my hot button items, and that is air quality, ventilation. And, you know, as we were in the middle of COVID, we kind of learned that, yeah, it wasn't just 6 feet, that you could catch this virus 20 feet away. I mean, it could float in the air for a while. And we're learning that norovirus, it's not just on your hands, you can also inhale it. And now, you know, there's a lot of influenza out there, and we talk a lot about air quality. But as far as I can tell, public health officials have done very little to enhance air quality. We don't mandate, you know, high-efficiency air filters, MERV 13s, for example, in public buildings. We don't test for carbon dioxide. So I guess just from your perspective as a pulmonologist, how do we get public health officials to start really paying attention to ventilation and air quality and making it a priority?
Well, we do shows like this where we talk about it and we make sure that people understand what it is. But from a, you know, obviously these things need to be mandated. These things need to be put into the regulations for us to get the better air quality. That's the stuff that we can actually regulate indoors. The stuff in terms of outdoor regulation, there actually, interestingly, has been an improvement over the last 50 to 100 years in terms of non-wildfire pollution and air quality. What hasn't gotten better and actually has gotten worse is the pollution and the particulate matter in the atmosphere from fires, and specifically wildfires.
Would you tell us more about that, please?
Yeah, so wildfires are an increasing issue, and they have a lot to do with COPD, asthma, people with lung problems, but it can also affect people without lung problems. Just to give you an idea, at least here in the United States, the issue of wildfires has been growing, and for anyone who even hasn't done research on this, they could probably in their own mental mind look back and think about the years back in the 80s, back in the 90s, and now what we're going through. What's interesting is that from 1979 to 2022, the mean duration of the fire season has increased by about 19% throughout that time period. So 19% more of the year from when we went from the 80s to now in the 2020s.
So what do you do as a pulmonologist when you're faced with, you know, forest fires in California? I mean, you've had some really nasty events over the last 6 months.
Yeah, and it's getting worse. In terms of wildfires, just to give you an idea here, if we were to take all of the organic aerosols, specifically out here in California, since you mentioned that in the U.S., despite the fact that the air is getting cleaner in general, 26% now of the organic aerosols in the western United States is coming directly from wildfires. They estimate in the United States that it costs about $10 to $20 billion a year in health costs. And if you were to look at it globally, they actually predict or estimate that over 300,000 premature deaths are occurring globally from these wildfires. And the reason has to come down to basically something called particulate matters. So there's this measurement. It's kind of like the way that we measure wildfires. We see the fire, we see what's going on, and we can see the danger with that fire itself. Obviously, if someone's in that fire, they can be burned and they can have toxic inhalation. But actually, the majority of the damage in terms of our health comes from the smoke from that fire, and it spreads for very, very wide areas, up to 10 miles. And the way that we measure this is something called the PM2.5 and the PM1. And let me explain what that is. The PM2.5 is basically a measurement of all of the particulates in the air that is 2.5 microns or less, okay? And we call this fine particulate matter. And then the PM1 is anything that's less than 1 micron. It's these particles that find their way into our lungs. They go down very, very deep into the small airways where we see a lot of the issues with COPD and asthma. And then the most amazing thing about this is that they're small enough that they can actually get into our blood and cause oxidative issues inside the person themselves.
Is there any way people can protect themselves from this particulate matter, from wildfire smoke, or, you know, what do you do? Can you wear a mask? Does that help? Can you run your air conditioning? Does that help? I just don't know. It seems like it's very pervasive.
It is pervasive, and it finds its way into your homes, no matter how well you seal it off. Yeah, there are things that you can do. Certainly, you because it's better indoors on wildfire days, especially if you're somebody who has lung problems, you want to limit your outdoor exposure, especially during those poor air quality days. And if you tune in, there are actually websites that the federal government actually has these websites, and there's also air quality management websites that will tell you what the air quality is in your area. And when you see that it's getting bad, those are the days that you want to plan your day in terms of being inside as much as possible. I'm a big advocate for getting outside into the fresh air and sunlight, except when you're not getting fresh air and sunlight. So being inside is important. Face masks can actually be beneficial, especially if we're talking about the N95 masks. Now, normally, I'm not somebody who is a big advocate of putting N95 masks on people with lung disease, because it does put a burden on the lung in terms of the amount of air that it can breathe in and out. Mm-hmm. However, there is some evidence that doing that in people with COPD, especially when the air quality is bad, can reduce COPD exacerbations. Now, you did talk about the MERV 13 filters that you can see commercially. They're actually air filtration systems that you can put together pretty easily. You can get some HEPA filters from a store, and using masking tape and a fan, you can actually build using the box that the fan comes in. For very cheap, you can build an air filter that you can turn on in your home, especially on these days. And for very inexpensive, you can actually have an in-home air filter.
Well, we'll put a link to the instructions for building that box.
Yeah.
In the show notes.
Yeah, we've interviewed the person who invented that concept. It's really fabulous. You know, we're based in North Carolina, and normally speaking, we don't have a lot of smoke. But last year, Canadian forest fires made it all the way down. The smoke was actually visible here in North Carolina. So air pollution is a problem in a lot of places that you wouldn't normally expect. I do want to transition from this issue of smoke to an issue of actual lung problems. You've mentioned COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and you've mentioned asthma, and they're both made worse if there are, you know, smoke and other pollutants in the air. So let's just talk a bit about asthma, if you don't mind. What exactly is it? Why is it made worse when there's air pollution? And then I want to talk about what we can do when someone actually has an asthma attack.
Yeah. So asthma is simply a reversible airway inflammation that causes the airways in your lung to get smaller. And we're talking about these small airways. So when you go down into let's imagine you're able to go down into the throat of somebody, you go into the major windpipe, and then it splits into a left and to a right. And after many, many generations of these splits, as you keep going down further and further into the lung, right before you get down to the very last part of the lung, where the air sacs are and the exchange of gases occur, you'll come to a small airway. And this small airway has no cartilage in it. It's very flexible. And there is smooth muscle that's there. And when the smooth muscle contracts in a circumferential way, because it surrounds the airway, it causes those airways to become smaller. And so what we have here is we have inflammation in those small airways, and that inflammation causes contraction of those smooth muscles. And when that happens, the airway becomes much smaller. Now, think about when you're taking a breath of air in and when you're taking a breath of air out. When you're taking in air, what happens is your diaphragm, which is that muscle at the bottom of your lung, is contracting, and it's causing the lungs to expand and get bigger. So when you're taking a breath in, all of those little airways in your lung, because the lungs are getting bigger, those airways are also getting a little bit bigger. So we don't typically have a problem when someone is taking a breath in. The problem occurs when they're exhaling that air. And so what happens in asthma, and something similar to this happens in COPD as well, is when you're breathing out, these airways, which are small to begin with because the smooth muscle has contracted there, as these airways are getting smaller and smaller, some of them actually close. And the air that should have been coming out in that exhalation doesn't come out. And as a result of that, you have less gas exchange and you're able to breathe out less.
And so when you go to take your next breath in, you can't get as much air, huh?
That is exactly correct. That's exactly correct. And so the primary problem with asthma is airway inflammation, reversible airway inflammation.
So when I was a kid, I did have asthma, and I took two medications, old-fashioned. One was ephedrine, and the other one was an epinephrine inhaler. And they worked amazingly well. Well, nowadays we have all kinds of other medications. We've seen the commercials for Trelegy. So I think most pulmonologists will go to a corticosteroid that might be fluticasone, but there are a bunch of them that you inhale. They will often add what's called a LABA, a long-acting beta agonist, which is a little bit like the epinephrine that I was inhaling. And then they may also have an anticholinergic drug, and you'll have to explain that. Tell us about what you prescribe when somebody comes into the emergency department, or when you just see somebody with good old-fashioned asthma as a child.
Well, that's a great question. And it's interesting because these guidelines have recently changed. There's an international organization called GINA, G-I-N-A, and it's basically the Global Initiative for the Treatment of Asthma. And these guidelines have changed in the last 4 or 5 years. But basically, the bottom line is because asthma is an airway inflammatory condition, the first line of defense, the first medicine that we would put on somebody today to make sure that they have maintenance therapy, this is in addition to a rescue inhaler, which we'll talk about. But the first line is an inhaled corticosteroid. And the purpose of this inhaler is to cool down the inflammation, because that's really the key that starts this. This is something that you take every day. This is not something that you take necessarily when you have a problem. This is the old way of this is the old paradigm. And so people are on these maintenance inhalers to try to cool down the inflammation, the corticosteroid. And then when they have a flare-up, when they're not breathing well, you need something to work immediately. And the inhaled corticosteroids don't work very quickly. And so you need something like you were taking when you were a kid, ephedrine or some epinephrine, something like this, something that basically stimulates something called the beta receptor. Now, the beta receptor is important to understand because the beta receptor are on those smooth muscles that we were talking about before in those small airways. And when those beta receptors are stimulated, it causes those smooth muscles to relax and allow that air to move in.
Dr. Schwelt, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to find out more about those beta receptors. And now, epinephrine, adrenaline, is available over the counter.
You're listening to Dr. Roger Schwelt. He's an associate clinical professor at the University of California, Riverside School of Medicine, and an assistant clinical professor at the School of Medicine and Allied Health at Loma Linda University. Dr. Schwelt is quadruple board certified in internal medicine, pulmonary diseases, critical care medicine, and sleep medicine through the American Board of Internal Medicine.
It's time for a short break. In just a minute, we'll find out what beta receptors are and why they matter for asthma. And what about corticosteroids?
Doctors sometimes talk about rescue inhalers. Well, what do they mean?
You'll also learn about the latest drugs being prescribed for asthma, monoclonal antibodies.
What are eosinophils and what role do they play in asthma and COPD? You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon. Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. Today, we're talking about some very common lung diseases, including asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD.
How can you start breathing better? People with COPD or asthma are especially vulnerable to exacerbations. How can they stay healthy?
Neither of these is considered an infectious disease. So how could an antibiotic like Z-Pak be helpful?
Our guest today is Dr. Roger Schwelt. He's an associate clinical professor at the University of California Riverside School of Medicine and an assistant clinical professor at the School of Medicine and Allied Health at Loma Linda University. Dr. Schwelt is quadruple board certified in internal medicine, pulmonary diseases, critical care medicine, and sleep medicine through the American Board of Internal Medicine. He lectures routinely across the country at conferences and for medical, PA, and RT societies. He's the director of a sleep lab and is the medical director for the Crafton Hills College Respiratory Care Program.
Dr. Schwelt, we were just talking about asthma and the various treatments that are available. You said that corticosteroids are there to kind of prevent the inflammation from getting a foothold and causing problems for people who are having wheezing problems. And then you were talking about beta receptors. So what's a beta and why do we want to stimulate it?
Yes. So the beta receptor, or specifically the beta 2 receptor, as it's known in the lung, is a receptor that causes the relaxation of the smooth muscle. And that's important. So we're going to want to stimulate that beta 2 receptor to cause relaxation of that smooth muscle to open up those airways. And there's a number of medications which do that. Albuterol, Ventolin, ProAir, these are all names that you might be familiar with. And these are things that work very quickly and open up those airways. There's also another type of beta agonists. They're known as long-acting beta agonists. Things like salmeterol, things like foradil or formoterol, these are long-acting beta agonists, which do that over a long period of time. Now, what's really interesting about that is that there is a long-acting beta agonist called formoterol, which is also actually a short-acting beta agonist as well. So some of your listeners may don't have them be surprised if they look at their rescue inhaler and it has something like formoterol on there, because it can also be used as a short-acting beta agonist. So these things open up the airways, allows you to breathe. The steroids reduce the inflammation so that those airways aren't going to be tightening up in the first place.
Now, you mentioned rescue inhalers. Just briefly, what are we talking about?
So those rescue inhalers are those ones that can open up those airways quickly. So albuterol, ProAir, Ventolin, these are the ones that I call them the American Express of inhalers. You should never leave home without it.
What about the new drugs? Because we're hearing about MABs, monoclonal antibodies, that are working against eosinophils. There's a whole new approach to asthma and COPD.
Yeah, so the two monoclonal antibodies that are really in prime time now are a medication called Xolair and Nucala. Nucala is mepolizumab and Xolair. So they are antibodies that are floating around in the body that are directed against something very specific. Now, in the case of Xolair, this is a antibody that is bound against IgE. What is IgE? It's an immunoglobulin that your body makes, but unfortunately, when it gets activated, it causes this allergic reaction that can cause asthma. And so that is one way of dealing with asthmatic responses when you've used the inhalers and they're still not working, that this monoclonal antibody can reduce the amount of IgE and help with those allergic responses and those asthmatic responses. The other one is Nucala. That one is directed against IL-5 or interleukin-5. Now, interleukin-5 is a cytokine that attracts eosinophils, and it can be actually very useful to have this type of...
What's an eosinophil, please?
Okay. An eosinophil is a very specialized white blood cell that attacks and is used against parasites, but can also be seen pathologically in these types of diseases that are related to allergies, so asthma and other allergic reactions.
How good are they?
Well, they seem to work. Patients who have elevated eosinophils and are not improving in terms of the symptoms, and they're on albuterol and these other inhalers, when we put them on Nucala or we put them on Xolair, we can take these patients who would normally be going to the hospital with multiple exacerbations, and we can prevent them from having to go to the hospital. Now, all of these things, of course, have risks, right? When you interrupt the body's ability to have immune responses, then you, for instance, can have an increased risk of parasitic infections, or you could have an increased risk for even some of these blood-borne cancers, so leukemia, things of that nature. So you have to do it. It's a risk-benefit ratio. If somebody is going to the hospital several times a year for a potentially life-threatening exacerbation of their lung disease, then it's certainly something that you have to consider.
Dr. Schwelt, I want to suggest to you that some years ago, we had a fascinating conversation with a family practice doctor who said he actually had done some studies suggesting strongly that there is a subset of people with asthma whose asthma is a reaction to a chronic infection, and he identified Chlamydia pneumoniae as a pathogen that was responsible. And he found that when he prescribed azithromycin in a particular protocol that he had developed, people's asthma cleared up. Have you witnessed anything of this nature?
Definitely, I have. And I can speak to that in terms of COPD, which COPD is very similar to asthma in terms of the portion of the lung that's affected, but here we have, irreversible airway obstruction. In terms of azithromycin, it's interesting that he talks about azithromycin because azithromycin is not only an antibiotic, but it also has very potent anti-inflammatory properties. And so it's well known and well used today in the literature that for people who have COPD and they have exacerbations, which are very similar to asthma exacerbations, one potential treatment is to put somebody indefinitely on azithromycin three times a week at 250 milligrams each dose. And this has been shown to reduce hospital admissions from COPD exacerbations.
Dr. Schwelt, I love the fact that you have a very open mind about a variety of healing modalities. Even though you are also in the emergency department, you have to deal with critical care situations. I want to ask about breathing exercises. It's rather controversial, but is there any evidence to support the idea that people can do certain kinds of breathing exercises to reduce their asthma problems?
The data is not as strong as it would be, for instance, on a lot of these other trials. And it's not because it's not as effective. It just hasn't been studied. And so usually when we make recommendations, we need to have good data. But my understanding when I've looked at this is that what they call boxed breathing can be beneficial in terms of helping with some of these exacerbations. So this is a situation where you breathe in for 4 seconds, you hold it for 4 seconds, you breathe out for 4 seconds, and you hold for 4 seconds. And this can be sometimes beneficial. The problem, though, sometimes is when you do have these asthma exacerbations is that you actually hyperventilate, and it's hard to do that in that kind of an acute situation. But in terms of something to do as a preventative, it may be beneficial.
I'm wondering if we could talk a bit more about COPD. Based on the TV commercials we're seeing, this must be a big problem. And of course, when you see TV commercials, the implication is that these wonderful new drugs are going to solve the problem. Can you give us some perspective on that?
And tell us what causes COPD. We're always told it's a smoking thing, but is that the only way that people end up with COPD? And then Terry's question about what to do.
Yeah, so it's not completely always a smoking thing. There are other factors that can cause COPD. There's occupational exposures or hazards. For instance, working in a coal mine, working in a place where there's fumes. There's obviously, well, not obviously, but in my mind, it's obvious because I've checked for this every single time I see a patient with COPD. There are genetic causes. There's a disease called alpha-1 antitrypsin, which is a condition where you don't have an enzyme in high enough quantities to prevent the breakdown of the elastic fibers. So the best way I can explain how this works with COPD is to think about what would happen if I were to take a needle and I were to put it into your chest and I were to pop your lung. You would know that your lung would immediately shrivel up into a little ball because it's full of elastic rubber bands, elastic fibers that wants that lung to contract. That's really important. And that's something that once you make your elastic fibers, you can never make more of them. And you want to preserve those elastic fibers as much as possible. At the same time that your lung is going to sort of shrink up, your chest wall is going to come out. It's going to enlarge. And so what you've done when you've put that needle in there, you've put a hole in the lung, you've decoupled the respiratory system in terms of the chest wall and the lung. The lung wants to collapse and the chest wall wants to come out. And the fact that there is a vacuum between those two things prevents them from doing either of those and it stays exactly where it is. Now, why that's important is to understand this point. And you can do this as I'm talking. Everybody just take a deep breath in, as deep as you can. And then I want you to relax and let that air out. Now you'll notice that your lung deflates, but it stops at a certain point. You could choose to blow more air out if you wanted to. But here's the point to understand is that it's the elastic fibers in your lung that cause the air to come out passively and cause the air to deflate and then stop exactly where it is. So those elastic fibers have to be defended against things that can break them down. And that protein called alpha-1 antitrypsin protects those elastic fibers. If you don't have enough of that protection, then your lungs will become more diseased more quickly and you can develop COPD. What happens in COPD is that the elastic fibers of your lung have become so diseased and so destroyed that essentially the chest wall wins that tug of war with your lungs and your lungs become very expanded. They become very enlarged. And then when that happens, the airways in the small airways become tightened just like they do in asthma and your lung becomes so enlarged that it's hard to take a breath in on top of that. People ask me what it's like to have COPD. And I say, this is, if you don't have COPD, this is the best way that I can mimic it if you want. So if you take a breath in, but not all the way in, okay, and then put a straw into your mouth and then try to breathe on top of where you've taken that breath in, that's what it feels like to have COPD. And your lungs are inflated, they're expanded, and you can't breathe very quickly in and out because there's obstruction. That's what the O stands for in COPD. So your question, though, is what type of medications work in this type of situation? And you'll find that the medicines that work in asthma also work very well in COPD. And that's because we're dealing with the same area of the lung. We're dealing with those same small airways, those same smooth muscles. The difference, though, is that instead of this being an inflammatory condition, this is more of an obstructive condition. And so we see medicines like anticholinergics being used. Now, what is an anticholinergic? An anticholinergic is a medicine that blocks the transmission of a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. And it's important to understand that not only do those smooth muscle cells have beta receptors that we like to stimulate to make them relaxed, as we do in asthma, but they also have what we call muscarinic receptors. And those muscarinic receptors are stimulated by these acetylcholines. Actually, they're blocked, which is good because when you block those muscarinic receptors, that also makes them relaxed as well. And so you'll see anticholinergics as medications that we use for COPD and asthma, and you'll see beta agonists as inhalers that we see in COPD.
So you have a lot of tools in the tool chest these days to deal with both asthma and with COPD. We just have about a minute and a half left. I'm curious about some of the signals that people should use to determine if they need to make a run to the emergency department and when they can treat at home. And I'm now thinking about, you know, that there's tuberculosis loose in the environment, and we have a lot of other nasty infections floating around. What are the early warning signs of problems?
Not being able to catch your breath, increasing shortness of breath, fevers, night sweats, chills, all of these are warning signs, especially if they've been going on for more than 4 weeks, that you should probably go see a healthcare professional at the emergency room or in the clinic if you can.
And in the 30 seconds we have left, your favorite cough remedies?
Ah, my favorite cough remedies. You know, if you were to take a small drop of eucalyptus oil and put that onto your neck, and maybe even a spoonful of honey. These are some low-cost things that you can do that are really easy to get without a prescription that help with cough. But this cough could be related to postnasal drip, gastroesophageal reflux disease, or asthma, and so those should also be treated.
So they need to be checked out. Dr. Roger Schwelt, thank you so much for talking with us on the People's Pharmacy today.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Dr. Roger Schwelt. He's an associate clinical professor at the University of California, Riverside School of Medicine, and an assistant clinical professor at the School of Medicine and Allied Health at Loma Linda University. Dr. Schwelt is quadruple board certified in internal medicine, pulmonary diseases, critical care medicine, and sleep medicine through the American Board of Internal Medicine. His current practice is in Beaumont, California, where he is a critical care physician, pulmonologist, and sleep physician at Optum, California.
In 2012, Dr. Schwelt and Kyle Allred founded MedCram, a medical education company with CME-accredited videos. His passion is demystifying medical concepts and offering people the tools for staying healthy.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Al Wodarski engineered. Dave Graydon edits our interviews. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music.
This show is a co-production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, with the People's Pharmacy.
Today's show is number 1,424. You can find it online at peoplespharmacy.com. That's where you can share your comments about today's interview. You could also reach us through email, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
Our interviews are available through your favorite podcast provider. You'll find the podcast on our website on Monday morning. This week's podcast offers an explanation for why some cough remedies work. It has to do with TRP channels. We also talk about how the heart drug amiodarone can affect the lungs, and we discuss the heart effects of OTC inhalers and long-acting beta agonists.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you could sign up for our free online newsletter to get the latest news about important health stories. When you subscribe, you also get regular access to information about our weekly podcast. You'll know ahead of time what topics we'll be covering. Speaking of the podcast, we would be so grateful if you'd consider writing a review of The People's Pharmacy and posting it to the podcast platform you prefer.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thanks for listening. Please join us next week.